before getting into my thoughts for you for this morning, I want to add just a little extra punch to one of the announcements that Lori made a little earlier, which anticipates what I'll be talking about next Sunday, which is our open house Sunday, where we do invite people, ask you to invite friends, family, co-workers, anyone you know who you feel would be interested in our religious community here, kind of the way we go about being a religious community. I know we're kind of shy about doing this kind of thing. I don't consider this proselytizing so much as just kind of making our availability known to people who would like to take advantage of it. So I'm going to be tailoring my sermon next Sunday as a way of introducing and presenting, as I say, who we are, what we're about, how we go about being a community of faith to persons who may not be that familiar with it. So please do think on this and invite a friend, family member, co-worker whom you think whose lives would be enriched and deepened by being a part of this community here. Over the past couple of weeks, as part of this Food for Thought Thursdays program we've been doing, a few of you folks, along with Lee Page and myself, have been taking part in a series called Writing Your Spiritual Autobiography. It's been a good time with that. One of the things we're going to be looking at this coming Thursday, those in a part of it, are going to be what we call turning points in our journeys of spirit and meaning. These could be, they could include places where we realize that got to a point where we realized we kind of needed a change of direction. If a particular path that we were on was no longer proving to be the right one. Well, I thought about that, and I thought about what I was going to say today, and I remember that one such turning point for me, esoteric as this may sound, was when I realized that the Christian doctrine or principle of the atonement no longer made any sense to me. And this was not just an intellectual debate I was having with myself. It went way past that. It really had to do with certain things from a very early age that I had emotionally and spiritually internalized and lived by, and then I found they were no longer meaningful or believable for me. That's not an unusual route. A lot of people find Unitarian Universalism. It may not be about this particular doctrine. What am I talking about here? You heard me do a little thing with the kids about atonement. It sounded like it was a good thing for all of us to do once in a while, which I believe it is. But it was the Orthodox Christian doctrine of the atonement that I found to be a stumbling block. It is one that holds that the primary reason that Jesus was on earth was to atone for the sins of humanity by way of his crucifixion and death. The historical reason for his execution may well have had to do with the Romans feeling a popular uprising in the land that they controlled, and so they had to kill him. But the greater purpose, the greater theological purpose is that in dying the excruciating death that he did, Jesus was taking upon himself both the sins and the fallen nature of humanity itself. He was making a sacrifice. Or taking death upon himself as an act of atonement on our behalf, so we didn't have to do it, thereby making us fit and worthy for the good graces and the love of God. By ourselves and by our own efforts, so this doctrine holds, we are not worthy of God's love and acceptance. But by taking our unworthiness upon himself and suffering and dying on our behalf, Jesus rendered us worthy of God anyway. Well, that's the Cliff Notes version. The doctrine of the atonement. You can go take whole courses and read books on it, but that's about the 2-minute version. Now, I can tell you, past experience, this is very, very powerful stuff when it gets applied in a certain way. I mean, if you're out there sitting in a pew, say at a revival meeting, or even in a regular church service like the ones in which I was raised, and perhaps some of you as well, I know Harry, you were, as a matter of fact, and you hear that God. Well, and you're sitting up there and you've got all this, you're feeling sort of a weight of guilt, misgivings over stuff you knew you did wrong. And then you hear that God will forgive you for all of that if you will just accept and believe what Jesus has already done for you. Okay, if you're in a particular state of mind, that'll get you off your feet and down to the altar pretty quickly. It will. Now, you're not completely off the hook. I mean, you're still expected to go and make amends, like I tried to demonstrate to Fran here this morning, you're still expected to go and make amends when it comes to those whom you have wronged, but you now do so as one who, thanks to Jesus' act of atonement, you've now been reconciled to God.
And this is one of the reasons why the cross is such a central symbol in Christianity. Because it's to remind those of that faith what Jesus has done on their behalf.
Well, as I said, one of the crises of faith I came to my early adulthood was when I began to think seriously about all this. Now, I thought seriously about it before, of course, but always from the stance of a believer and acceptance. Now I found myself thinking critically. And it was like, wait a minute here. Sure, perfect I'm not, as pictured David Wells titled his autobiography. Perfect I'm not. Indeed, I know I've done some things that have been harmful and hurtful to others, for which I do need their forgiveness. Yeah, I can admit there's a fallen side to my nature that on occasion, even when I know what is the right and good thing to do, I still don't do it. There are times in my life, yeah, sure, when I can actually identify with what St. Paul said when he wrote, the good that I would, I cannot do. Not all the time, but I've had those moments enough times to know the guy was on to something. But then, even given all that, I see nothing in my misdeeds, as much as I regret them, and nothing in my essential nature, flawed as I know it is, I see nothing in all of that that would warrant a poor and terribly misunderstood individual to have to die a horrible death on my behalf some 2,000 years ago. That was kind of where it began to break down. At some point, I realized those dots no longer connected for me. And my path to the turning point at that time, which eventually led me into this faith tradition called Unitarian Universalism. I should add here that I hope you know this of me by now. I do not denigrate in any way the faith of others for whom those dots do connect. I'm just saying I got to a point where they no longer connected for me. And interestingly enough, it was when I found my way into the Unitarian Universalist neighborhood at home that I learned that one of the early architects of our faith went through a similar kind of struggle of mind and spirit as I had. It was comforting to learn that. Clear back in 1803, or thereabouts, he worked on this thing off and on for several years, a man named Reverend Hosea Ballou wrote what is now regarded as one of the founding documents of American Universalism, called A Treatise on Atonement. Now, the Reverend Ballou was originally a New Hampshire Baptist country preacher. You got to figure with a name like that, Ballou, he had some French-Canadian blood in his family tree somewhere there. He was largely self-educated. His formal education went to about the third grade. He was a very brilliant man. He switched over to Universalism just as Universalism was getting a toehold in this country after apparently mulling over some of the same thoughts that I had had about 170 years before I had them. So his treatise on atonement, I'm going to have to do the Cliff Notes version on this one too, held that Jesus' mission on earth was indeed to save us or help deliver us from our fallen selves, but not through an act of atonement by way of his death, but rather through the life, his life, and teachings that can call and guide us from our sometimes broken selves to a more holistic and restored and reconciled to God, as Ballou would have put it, state of living. Jesus' death was actually held up as an example of what it can sometimes mean to remain faithful to your principles and your values and your purposes and not as an atoning act on behalf of humanity. Well, this treatise Ballou wrote served as the basis for Universalist Christianity through the 19th and into the mid-20th century. And I would say, as I've come to have dialogue with some of my more liberal Protestant clergy and lay folks, that a good deal of sort of your mainstream, moderate to liberal Protestant Christianity today contains a good deal of what Ballou was saying over 200 years ago. Well, moving on then, I think the care, though, It's like kind of a hinting at it. But what leads to exercise? When it comes to throwing off or getting rid of a particular doctrine or a dogma, is not to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater, to use what I know is an overworked metaphor, but it still works. The need for atonement, for making amends, for both seeking and offering forgiveness, and for seeking to live a more reconciled and at peace with oneself kind of a life. These are very real human needs. They transcend the bounds of any religion. This is why I believe it is, this is why I think they are common themes that you can find in any number of the world's faiths today. As I mentioned with the children earlier, today it marks the Jewish observance of Yom Kippur. It also marks the culmination of a 10-day observance of the Jewish New Year, beginning with Rosh Hashanah, which means head or beginning of the year. The 10 days from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur are as sacred on the Jewish calendar as are the 7 days from Palm Sunday to Easter on the Christian one. And as I said, Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement. There's that word again. Well, I'm far less familiar with how the idea of atonement is dealt with in Judaism than I am in Christianity. I can speak to the Christian part from personal experience. Some of you probably can from the perspective of Judaism if you were raised in that faith. But here's what I know. As a person of the Jewish faith approaches the Jewish New Year, Yom Kippur, it is important that they do so by first settling all of their offenses and misdeeds of the previous year with both God and their fellow human beings. With God, the Yahweh, the settling up or the atoning is done by means of fasting on Yom Kippur, observing certain rituals in the synagogue. However, the idea is, if I understand it, before you get to that point, you are supposed, before you get around to settling up with God, you are first supposed to settle up any debt of wrongdoing you've incurred with any of your fellow human beings in the previous year. You're supposed to do that first. In other words, you make your amends with your fellow human beings, you seek their forgiveness in whatever ways you can, and then God is ready to settle up with you. Well, my theology balks a little bit at the idea of a supreme being who dispenses divine forgiveness. I still have to say, I like the process here. Maybe put it in another language, get right with any of your fellow human beings whom you've wronged in any way, and then you can get right with the universe, or the rest of life, or the larger life that you're a part of. As I say, we all need to do that from time to time, Jewish or not. The thing I like about the Jewish approach is that nobody has to die a very horrible death within that scheme of things. Well, moving out from this a bit then, what does it mean to seek forgiveness and offer apologies? I'm going to try to keep this as simple as I can by saying in my mind, I put apologies or petitions for forgiveness, I put them in two categories. Keep it real simple, category one and category two. All right. A category one apology is one that is offered. This is the one, the category one is not the one I put a whole lot of stock in. Category one apology is one that is offered primarily for the sake of covering or saving one's behind. Now, you see this in the political realm all the time. You know, like this mess that United States Senator George Allen of Virginia has created for himself by referring to a young American of Indian descent with a racial slur and has been trying to work his way out of it ever since. These kinds of apologies often begin with the word if. Now, whether it's fair of me or not, whenever I hear apology and the first word out of the mouth of the person who's offering it is if, I tend to discount the rest of what I'm hearing. You know, it's usually like, if my unfortunate choice of words is what offends to some, or if my well-intended actions have caused pain for some, and then it kind of goes from there. That's a nifty little construct, and what it really does, if you listen real closely and think about what it means, what that really does is take the responsibility off the person who is ostensibly offering the apology and actually places the onus of being offended or hurt on the very person to whom the apology is supposedly being extended. Just kind of stands it on its head. With most apologies then that begin with the word if, I'll leave a little wriggle room in there, but most of the ones that begin with the word if, there's really no taking up responsibility for one's actions. It still kind of puts it on the person, well, gee, if you were offended, gosh, I'm sorry. You know, what is that? That's a category one apology is what I'm calling. All right. Category two. These are the ones where one really does seek forgiveness. And ones that are offered in the spirit of atonement for a wrong committed. A category two apology, as I'm calling it, is one that is offered when we know we have betrayed some of the principles, the values, and the actions that we're attempting to live by. Or from the knowledge that we have brought harm, done harm, or brought a rupture to a relationship that we actually value. This is usually a personal relationship, but it could be a larger relationship that we feel we have with some aspect of humanity, like itself, or to say the relationship we have with some of the values and principles, morals and ethics that we hold most dear for ourselves. Whenever that relationship, whenever we know we've done something that has violated or ruptured that relationship and need to make amends for it, that's what I call a Category 2 apology or a Category 2 act of atonement. I don't know that I can say much more about Category 2. The point is fairly self-explanatory, other than to note that they are offered for the sake and in the hope, as I say, of restoring a relationship. I also know, as I know you do too, seeking forgiveness and offering amends and atonements does not accomplish the restoration of that relationship all on its own. It only addresses one side of a broken relationship or an injury. I may need to offer an apology. I may need to make good on an injury I have caused in order to be in the right relationship with myself. That's pretty important right there. The person on the other side, the one from whom I am seeking forgiveness, may or may not be in a position to accept and extend it in a way that will bring about true reconciliation. This gets me to the flip side of this matter of forgiveness and atonement that I'd like to speak to as the final part of my thoughts for this morning. Dr. Jack Kornfield, the clinical psychologist, is also a very well-respected, renowned teacher of Buddhism. He noted in one of his writings once that forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. I had to work on that one for a while. At first reading, it struck me as kind of unduly cynical until I figured out, or think I figured out, what he meant by it. I think he meant that forgiveness is about how much of and in what way you want to carry some of the more painful parts of your past with you and when you want to let them go. I think that's what he means when he says that. And as I thought through Dr. Kornfield's words and tried to make some sense of them, I also recalled something going way back about 20 years or so that a former hostage had once said after he had been released from his captivity of 500 and some days. This hostage was Father Lawrence Jenko. In the mid-1980s, Father Jenko was the director for Catholic Relief Services in Lebanon. And he was kidnapped and held hostage, as I said, for 564 days in Beirut by a radical Shiite extremist group that was operating there at the time. One of his co-captors was Terry Anderson. Terry Anderson was the one that got a lot of the attention after the release had taken place. What Jenko said is very important. For after his release, some time after his release, he was interviewed and he spoke about why, even though he knew he could never forget the horrible ways in which he had been treated, why he felt he needed to take, after working through a lot of understandable anger, why he felt he needed to forgive his captors. Here's what he said. It may be because one guard would kneel on my pancreas with his full weight, but I went through acute pancreatitis recently, and I had a 20% hearing loss due to my treatment in captivity. There are all kinds of pain we enter into in our lives, but I don't want to lug my pain on so that it becomes the focal point of my history. Think about that last line. I don't want to lug my pain on so that it becomes the focal point of my history. What Father Jenko was saying was that he came to a point, as I say, after I'm sure he had to work through a pretty good level of anger, a pretty good amount of anger, he came to the point where he had to forgive his captors as a way of ridding himself of the psychic pain he was carrying from his days in captivity. He knew that his physical maladies were going to be with him for the rest of his life. He died of cancer about 10 years ago. But he also knew that he couldn't carry the burden of hatred for what had been done to him for the rest of his life. He could not allow his hatred to define the remainder of his life. Forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. He couldn't change that past. He had to let go of the idea that he could change it. Forgiveness was coming to that point. For Father Jenko, giving up that hope was necessary in order to free him up so he could truly live out the rest of his life. My history, as he put it, is much more than 564 days in Lebanon. For Father Jenko, offering forgiveness, even if his captors, he was never able to come face to face with his captors again. So he didn't know if he ever got any kind of reciprocity from them or not. But his offering forgiveness was his way of reclaiming and reaffirming the story and the history of his whole entire life. Now I realize that not everyone who has been grievously and painfully wronged or sinned against, to put it in more traditional language, can get to the place that Father Jenko did. I know that doesn't always happen. I know that adult survivors of early childhood abuse, for example, physical, emotional, sexual, whatever it was, I know that adult survivors of early childhood abuse find it very difficult, for all kinds of understandable reasons, to get to that point. Which is why I'm not going to stand here and say that everybody who has been terribly hurt could or should follow Father Jenko's path and example. But I do feel it is right, to offer him and his ordeal and his ability to reconcile himself to it as an example of just how powerful the act of forgiveness can be for the person who is offering it, if she or he can get to that point. So I'll close with this. Religious communities, what we are gathered here, whatever their orientation, however liberal or conservative they may be, they are also human communities. As such, they contain, as we do here, contain within them the very best that is within men and women and children. And they also contain within them our human foibles and our shortcomings and our failings. We bring them both here. These are the lives that we bring to a community like this one. As we come seeking greater wholeness, greater levels of relationship, and sometimes seeking the forgiveness and the reconciliation we need in order to get to those levels. We live our lives by coming into and then occasionally falling out of right relationships with others and with life and with all that transcends our life. We live our lives by coming into and then being called back into the circle of life and love itself. So let us each do our best, do what we can, to keep that circle whole and to keep that circle growing in the life we are continually growing, in the life we are continually creating here. With that in mind, let's sing together a closing hymn, Break Not the Circle, number 323.